Thank you, Barry. Okay. So I'm just going to say a few things about what led me to write this piece. My interest in the erasure of history, which is at the center of the piece on Arendt, arose in part out of an encounter with events in the United States surrounding the war in 2003, although the questions may have been implicit for some years in the work I was doing on trauma. I turned back to Arendt because of a series of questions she had raised concerning the nature of politics that seemed to address the problem of history and its potential erasure in terms of some internal paradoxes of the political realm, which for her is a central site where history is made. For me, this paradox has to do, the central one, has to do in particular with the movement in European history between revolution, which for her is an exemplary political act, and totalitarianism, which is a political form that, at least as she describes it, attempts to undo the principles that underlie true political action, and in particular the principle of natality, that she, as she describes it. Thus, with regard to revolution, it's already a peculiar form. She says that, first of all, in On Revolution, she argues that politics is a site of beginnings of the human as the capacity to originate, or the principle of natality. And revolution is exemplary of this because she says it is the new experience of the capacity to begin something new. So it's, in a sense, a somewhat paradoxical and radical origination as a form of true action. And the peculiarity of this particular form of action, this particular kind of event, is that before the event, the revolutionaries didn't actually plan to be revolutionaries. They didn't intend a revolution, but rather wanted to return to something they had felt had been forgotten. On the one hand, on the other hand, after the event, those who experienced it misinterpreted it as part of the necessary movement of history. So she said we got a philosophy of history out of the revolution rather than a philosophy of action. Thus, the revolutionaries didn't plan or intend a revolutionary event. It came as a surprise to them, and afterwards, they misinterpreted it as something necessary, which seemed to lead to a set of revolutions that ultimately led to political forms that undid the newness of revolutionary action. So the revolution was a kind of a missed event. Something truly historical in Arendt's sense that it couldn't be predicted or integrated into a line of causality in any simple sense. And it's an action that cannot be determined in advance. But this history ultimately leads to a politics that undoes itself. This politics in the origins of totalitarianism is described as an attempt to eliminate the capacity to begin, to originate, to eliminate the principle of totality. That's the ultimate aim of the totalitarian regimes. So these are regimes that are political, but they are also eliminating the very possibility of the political. And so it's captured in the peculiarity of calling totalitarian regimes new, because the new is the mark of the political for her. So the questions this raised for me were first, what does it mean to have a political system that eliminates the political? Secondly, or more generally, since politics becomes political history, in this story, what does it mean for a political history to be constituted by or as its own undoing? What kind of political action and what kind of history is totalitarianism? Secondly, what is the nature of the story of the history that leads from revolution to totalitarianism? Certainly it can't be a logic or a necessity because that wouldn't be history for Arendt. So how do we think about that history? And the lying essays, Truth and Politics and Lying in Politics, are, in my opinion, ways of responding to these questions. She, at least I see her as rethinking problems of political action in terms of the lie. and likewise as a question concerning language as it is inscribed in politics. And she says, of course, as I wrote about her, since all action in politics involves the possibility of lying, which is another kind of action, the history of politics is also the history of the lie. And this creates a problem because the history of action and the history of lying are at odds with each other. Action depends upon facts, she said. In order to change the world, you have to know the facts. Lying is a form of action that denies the facts. So the two kinds of actions depend upon and also are at odds with each other. So the possibility of political history as action appears to depend upon the possibility of its radical denial, which is another kind of history. So the history of action and history as the denial of facts are intertwined and produce, for her, a historical trajectory from what she calls the traditional to the modern lie. That is, from lies in the service of politics, which she says has always been the case. Lies are always used in the political realm to serve political ends, to lies in the modern world that she says are rather in the service of rather politics in the modern world, which is in the service of an entirely fictitious world, so kind of taking over of the lie, to expand to something that is no longer simply a lie in the traditional sense, something intended, conscious, individual, etc. So the questions raised for me by these essays are, what is the history of this movement from the traditional lie to the modern lie? Especially if this history is written from within the world of the modern lie, what status does it have? Secondly, what is the historicity of the world of the modern lie itself if it consists in denying the facts of its own history? What is a history of the undoing of history? What does it mean to speak of history in this case? For she does not claim, Arendt does not claim an end to history, only a difference in its nature. Thus, what is the nature of the movement from totalitarianism to image making? If in fact we can distinguish the two that clearly, it's not absolutely clear in her case. And finally, for me, the figure of explosion tries to capture the paradoxical nature of this history of the undoing of history. Third, what is the nature of the political fact if it can be made by being erased, as in the case of the dropping of the bomb, at least as I interpret it as being implicit in her essay? And finally, what kind of knowledge or truth can take place in this world? What is the nature of testimony? And could it perhaps constitute itself an intervention in the political sphere? So those are my questions, and I'm glad to hear the responses.
As I came to this session, I passed the Senate House, where, as you know, students are occupying the lawn to protest a decision by the Vice Chancellor to cut student bursaries. I wanted to begin by mentioning that if I weren't here at this moment, I'd be out there with them on the lawn and encourage you to support them in their protest, in particular to sign one of the petitions that's circulating about opposition to this iniquitous policy of cutting the student bursaries. It's important, I think, to keep in mind that we're facing not just the threat of the absolute destruction of the humanities in Britain, but that this is also part of a concerted and planned and ideologically motivated attack on the universities and on the whole public sphere. If the plans of the government succeed, the British university system will be seriously harmed. The study of the humanities in this country will be completely destroyed, and our social fabric will suffer perhaps irremediable damage. In addition, the envisaged changes do not have a clear economic rationale, even if one uses the narrowest of economic measures. One thing we can be sure of is that a country that destroys its university system will not be best placed to cope with the economic environment of the 21st century. Okay. Many of you will recall that during the recent general election, David Cameron repeatedly said that the National Health Service had suffered a series of destabilizing massive reorganizations, and that his government did not plan any major changes. Now, either Mr. Cameron had not spoken with Andrew Lansley about this, in which case one might wonder about his competence, or Mr. Lansley has been making up policy about one of the most important sectors of our society, namely the health system, on the hoof during the past few months, which doesn't speak well for his competence, or Mr. Cameron was not being fully frank and forthcoming with the electors when he said that no major changes in the National Health Service were on the cards under a Tory government. This leads us immediately to one of the topics of today, namely lying. It's often seemed to me odd that lying has had such a bad press in the modern world. And I can explain this only by the persistence of certain Christian attitudes. Christianity, after all, has a notorious hostility to lying. In claiming that lying has a bad press, I do not, of course, mean to say that I think it's a good thing to lie, merely to ask whether lying deserves the uniquely reprehensible status sometimes assigned to it, and whether in some context there might not be more to be said for it than is often acknowledged. In a way, the fact that a government feels the need to lie to its population can be seen as a progressive trait. Governments that were utterly sure of themselves and of their own power and ruthless in the use of that power would not need to lie. So the fact that they need to lie can, it seems to me, not unreasonably be seen as a kind of advance over the state of primitive brutality in which force and the threat of force are routinely and invariably used. To be sure, Christianity has traditionally argued the opposite of this, so that Dante, for example, places liars lower down in hell than the violent on the grounds that the corruption of a higher human faculty, namely the faculty of speech, is worse than a corruption of a lower faculty, namely the faculty of immediate exercise of physical power. So one question I would suggest we ask is lying always and in all contexts an absolute evil, even if the alternative is the direct use of force? A second question is lying, meaning by that term intentional assertion of something one knows to be untrue, is that necessarily worse for the liar than telling an untruth the liar does not know is an untruth? Finally, is being lied to necessarily worse for a person being told an untruth by someone who is himself taken in by it? I submit not that lying is sometimes clearly a good, but that in all three of these cases, the jury is out. It's often been noted that ancient Greek philosophers were obsessed with the distinction between appearance and reality, but that they showed little interest in lying versus truth-telling as a basic moral issue. In general, the idea that under all circumstances it's categorically wrong to lie, as distinct from the thought that it's painful to be taken advantage of when one has fallen for a plausible lie, seems to be a relatively late development. Thus, in the so-called archaic period, Odysseus is generally, if not universally, admired for being such a consummate liar. In a well-known passage in the Odyssey, the goddess Athena appears to Odysseus in the semblance of a young herdsman and asks him who he is. And when he, Odysseus, embarks on a characteristically ingenious and highly embroidered and completely untrue story, she interrupts him and says the reason she loves him is she's almost a bigger liar than he is. He's almost a bigger liar than she is. And that if she didn't watch out, she would even be taken in by him. So she loves him because he's such a wonderful liar, just like her. If she wasn't a goddess, he might deceive even her. Also, now notice, in contrast to what a contemporary reader might expect, the 200 odd pages of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics contains discussions of all kinds of virtues and vices, moderation, justice, brutality, perversion, but only 2 pages devoted to truthfulness and its opposite. And even truthfulness and its opposite in Aristotle is not focused on saying the truth, rather it's focused on the way in which one lives. That is, Aristotle says, truth or failing to truth is a failure to live in a way that's commensurate with one's own merits. So I'm lying if I live a more extravagant life than my merits would warrant me to do. So a liar is a person who tries to live above the estate to which he is entitled, or who lives, I'm sorry, I've lost a page of my text here. Excuse me. I've got it here. Oh dear. Or is too modest and self-depreciating. Similarly, you remember, Plato is completely insouciant about what has come to be called the noble lie. Poets are to be banished from the city because they confuse the real and the apparent. That's the real problem, confusing the real and the apparent. And that's intolerable. But the philosopher kings know reality, and in the interests of maintaining the city in a good state, they may lie to the populace with impunity. There was a kind of failure vis-a-vis the truth that Greek philosophers worried about. But that was not the intentional failure to tell a truth that one knew, but rather the failure to see a truth because one was taken in by appearances. Although, that is, ancient philosophers did not, in fact, in general, worry about lying and truth-telling. They did worry about true speech and did not worry about true speech as a general touchstone for moral character. There was one particular context in which they were interested in truth, and that is in context described by what Foucault has focused attention on recently, namely the notion of paresia, free-spokenness, outspokenness, saying the truth in the face of power. Paresia was the virtue of speaking the truth rather than a direct lie. It wasn't the virtue of speaking the truth rather than a direct lie, but of speaking out and saying everything as opposed to keeping silent, or saying only what will be acceptable to one's interlocutor. This truth-telling is a kind of outspokenness, and as outspokenness, it is a moral and political act, and it's an act of political courage. But note, it's a virtue not by virtue of the fact that it says the truth. It's a virtue by virtue of the fact that you're courageously saying everything that needs to be said, rather than something else. So this outspokenness is opposed to discretion, timidity, or telling only the acceptable part of the full story, and that's a completely different thing from talking about, from telling the literal truth as opposed to a literal falsity. Now this might be taken to throw some doubts on the claim which Professor Carruth takes from the mid-20th century journalist Hannah Arendt, namely the view that the liar is the political man and the truth teller is not. So in one of your, in the paper here, we have, I read this in the paper, truth telling is actually much less political in its nature than the lie. While the liar is a man of action, the truth teller most emphatically is not. The liar is an actor by nature. He wants to change the world. Now, there seem to me to be two rather different ideas operating here, both of which are incorrect and or are at least extremely misleading. The first is the idea that the truth is simple. It's out there for people to see, and therefore you just see it, and you don't see it, and you say it, or you don't say it. The second is that the decision to tell the truth is apolitical, in contrast with the highly political action of lying. To say that truth-telling is non-political means presumably that it's not based on a calculation about the possible effects on the distribution of power or an active concern to change the political situation. So to start with the first of these conceptions, namely that the truth is relatively simple. In contrast to that, it seems to me, what is out there to be observed in politics is not usually the truth, but what's out there to be observed is usually what Plato calls doxa, an inherently unstable and shifting configuration of half-truths, misperceptions, opinions too ill-formulated even to have a determinate truth value, wishful thinking, ungrounded supposition, and fantasy that would need to be scrutinized. Think of the content of the internet. The realm of doxa, of mere opinion and appearance, is the world in which everyone almost always actually lives. And it is most emphatically the world in which politics is conducted. The truth, however, as the Greeks put it, is deep down there. Aletheia en boutho, that the truth is deep down in the well. It's not up on the surface. You have to look for it and you have to extract it, bringing it to the surface. It doesn't lie around on the street waiting to be observed by anyone who glances in its general direction. To see and recognize the truth requires the exercise of a certain kind of systematic violence on doxa, forcing the inchoate and formless mass of undifferentiated opinions that circulates around us into a coherent shape. This is a thought that Arendt could have got from Heidegger had she been paying attention, or from Nietzsche, or from Foucault. Nietzsche, at the end of the 19th century, spoke of a will to truth that was necessary to explain how we came to be able to get access to the true and to keep a firm grip on it. And he correctly, I think, emphasized the amount of asceticism that was required of a human being to resist our natural impulse to wishful thinking and to see the world as it is rather than as we would like it to be. If the truth is not simple, it's also the case that straightforward lying, that is, the intentional telling of what one knows is not true, is only one particular case of human duplicity. Christian ethics focuses on this case, and it's easy to see that cases like this, do not exhaust the infinite multiplicity of ways in which people can mislead one another. I can tell you something that's literally true, but which I know you will misinterpret. I can insinuate rather than assert false beliefs. I can fail to inform you of relevant facts. I can do all of this without saying a single false word. It seems a mere prejudice to think that applying these tactics of insinuation and misleading is in any way less reprehensible than straightforward lying. So that's the first misconception, that the truth is out there and it's simple. Second, the liar is the natural political actor trying to skew the world of power to his own advantage, but the truth teller is apolitical. Now, it seems to me that, again, Professor Carruth's example, again taken from Arendt, is a counterexample to this claim, the example of the publication of the Pentagon Papers. Those of you who are younger won't remember this, but the Pentagon Papers were a secret government history of the origins and the conduct of the war in Vietnam. And they were leaked, as you remember, by a security analyst named Daniel Ellsberg, who eventually turned against the war, and leaked them in order to bring the war to an end. So he told the truth in order to bring the war to an end. It was a political action that he performed. As Arendt says, well, maybe she doesn't say that, the Pentagon Papers were politically significant not because they contained any single new fact truthfully told. And it's true, when they came out, there wasn't anything in there that we didn't know somehow. It was not that there was some fact in there that nobody knew. They were either well known or they were easily accessible, but they'd never been conjoined in public in the way they had been conjoined into a unitary account. And what I want to suggest is, it's not so much then that the government had lied, because there was a lot of true information out there. It wasn't that they lied, they'd said to you what they knew was false. Rather, even true information had been provided in a form that made it maximally difficult to put it together with other true information so as to make a coherent picture. So it's also, it's not the case that people who actively or self-deludedly participated in this obfuscation were the men of action, whereas Daniel Ellsberg was a mere apolitical truth teller. Ellsberg's telling of the truth by leaking the documents was itself an explicit attempt to change reality. Arendt and Carruth suggest that lying is in some sense more pervasive or different in modern politics than it has been in the past, and that it takes the form of the big lie, the intentional propagation of something one knows to be false. It is, however, completely unclear to me why anyone would think that lying was more prevalent in modern politics than in the politics of other ages. Think of the dozens or hundreds of cases of massive global lying for political purposes recorded in Herodotus, Thucydides, and the other ancient historians. Think of the donation of Constantine. Against this comparative background, the straightforward big lie, that is the direct intentional assertion of a non-truth, such as that Trotsky was in the pay of the Gestapo and was planning to kill Stalin, that sort of big lie does not seem to me an especially significant or indicative feature of the modern world. What is different about modern politics is that there's a new actor on the stage, the state. And the state can now have an organized policy on information and a formal apparatus to enforce this policy of a kind that was not available in the ancient world. And of course, Tony Blair was a master of setting that sort of thing up. A modern government does not so much straightforwardly lie as try to keep politically active populations in a state of doxa while maintaining an air of candor. They do this by subtly keeping the individual pieces of the puzzle of their policies apart so that the whole picture can't be recognized. So the characteristic thing is not the straightforward lie. The characteristic thing is the failure of what you might think of as paresia, saying everything. It's the failure of being able to put things together which actually belong together. And they do this by keeping the individual pieces of the puzzle apart, by flooding the public sphere with irrelevant information, by diverting attention to rather than denying uncomfortable facts, by deniably suggesting connections that do not exist. We all know about that. By indirectly fostering wishful thinking in the evaluation of evidence, etc. None of these processes is interestingly analyzed, it seems to be, on the model of the conscious suppression of strict factual truth. That's not the right model for these sorts of things. Again, Foucault seems to me to be the contemporary philosopher who is best at analyzing the structural constraints on the flow of information and the formation and dissemination of knowledge in the modern state. Arendt's emphasis on construing modern politics under the category of the lie is a rather not useful way to proceed, encouraging naive moralizing and discouraging serious thought. If I understand her correctly, Carruth also wishes to suggest that it's a specific characteristic of modern politics that actors get taken in by their own propaganda and begin really to act as if the false images they projected for rhetorical purposes were the truth, and this leads to self-destructive behavior. False images projected for rhetorical effect, of course, have a long history. They've been around for a long time. Think again of the Iliad. Think of the Iliad, right? Patroclus goes out in the armor of Achilles. So he's in the armor. Nobody can tell he's Patroclus. He looks like Achilles. He's got Achilles' armor on. He falsely projects, for rhetorical purposes, the image of being Achilles coming back to the thing. And he eventually seems to be taken in by his own pretense because he thinks, contrary to what he's been told, that he'll be able now. He's got the armor of Achilles. He can take Troy. And he's disabused of that by being struck down, as you know, from behind by Apollo and then shot and killed. So he's taken in by his own propaganda. He acts in a way that's self-destructive, and that's the end of the story. Or, to shift a little bit, this structure is very clearly set out by Hegel in the Phenomenology in 1806 about recognition, the dialectic of master and slave. And he presents it as a recurrent pattern in human history. So I find it hard to see this as specifically modern. So finally, Professor Carruth contends that the prevalence of lying in modern politics puts us in danger of losing our grip on reality altogether and undermining the very possibility of history. Now, there was a slightly hysterical moment in the 1940s and 50s, symbolized by George Orwell's 1984, in which many people feared that the very notion of a fact would be lost from politics. But I think now we can see that that was a misplaced fear. Similarly, in 1967, Guy Debord, La Société du Spectacle, enunciated a theoretically sophisticated way, the fear that in the modern world, the image was on the point of making itself completely self-sufficient and replacing politics, replacing reality in politics. So he says, les images qui se sont détachées de chaque aspect de la vie fusion dans un cours commun, la spécialisation des images du monde se retrouve accomplie dans le monde de l'image autonomisée, où le mensonger s'est menti à lui-même. Arendt's discussion belongs, it seems to me, to this rather dated context, the context of the 50s and 60s. I'm almost finished. Of course, we live, as most people do, in the world of doxa, of shifting appearances and opinions, of indeterminate truth value. In the past, however, reality has had a way of maintaining its bite and undoing any attempt to turn it into a mere image. As long as that continues to be the case, I think we don't have to fear that history will end.
Professor Carruth refers to the emergence in her essay of a non-mechanistic, non-deterministic historicity of the modern lie from Arendt's two essays, Truth in Politics and Lying in Politics. I'd like to suggest that Arendt's idiosyncratic narrative of modernity and conception of truth make it difficult to accept her philosophically informed history of lie, of the lie, that is to say, Arendt's. In Lying in Politics, Arendt's response to the publication of the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War, she argued that American policymakers were disconnected from reality. Self-deception about the justification for the war undermined their judgment and encouraged them to lie the truth, attempting to create new political realities in the impossible pursuit of an image of America's omnipotence and goodness. This uncontroversial claim stemmed from a more ambitious one, made in greater detail in the earlier of the two essays, Truth in Politics, published in 1967. There, Arendt suggested that the 20th century saw a radical shift in the history of the lie. This was catalyzed by the spread of organized deception by governments directed at their own populations. It displaced politics by undermining the sense of reality upon which political agents, whether they be politicians or citizens, depended. It also threatened the existence of factual truth and the conditions of possibility for historical knowledge. The conception of truth Arendt establishes in Truth in Politics is problematic, to say the least. Distinguishing between rational and factual truths, she argues that rational truths, mathematical, scientific, and philosophical, are givens that even if lost or suppressed, may be rediscovered at a later date because they're always out there. Factual truths, on the other hand, are mostly knowledge about the outcomes of human action and are fragile and contingent. In her words, they have no necessity. They could have been otherwise. According to Arendt, they constitute a sense of reality. She uses the fact of the German invasion of Belgium on August 4th, 1914, as an example of this. Other decisions to go to war could have been made, but in a sign of the paradoxical stubbornness of facts, for such a fact to have been successfully denied would require a government to have a power monopoly over the whole world. This would suggest that factual truths have a rather prosaic character in Arendt's account. However, Arendt also describes their function in existential terms and in conjunction with various spatial metaphors. She says, no permanence, no perseverance in existence can even be conceived of without men willing to testify what is and what appears to them because it is. In the absence of theological certainties, for Arendt, factual truth about past human action provides a ground for existence. In the closing lines of Truth in Politics, she says that they are the ground on which we stand. As the very texture of the political realm, they provide the boundaries of debate for the public sphere. Hence lies, which tear holes in this fabric, threaten the basis of our sense of reality, the prerequisite for judgment in politics. Yet factual truths, she argues, cannot be used to counter lies in politics in the same way as lies are used to destroy truth. Factual truths are, according to Arendt, reflective and unpolitical unless put into an interpretive context. In contrast, lies have an affinity with action. They're performative, an attempt to alter something in the world, and therefore political. In her pessimistic Lying and Politics, organized lying, in the form of near-universal deception employed by the American government, destroys factuality. In this context, she argues, truth-telling can easily be a political act. The spectre of contemporary parallels with WikiLeaks looms large. But it doesn't seem to me, even while following the lines of her argument, that the political use of truth is only possible in such extreme circumstances. This is partly because her definition of factual truth as fundamentally unpolitical is unconvincing. Philosophers of language have long argued that perspectives and values are introduced whenever factual truths are observed or presented by agents. Facts are never simply nakedly there. Arendt recognises this to some degree, asking rhetorically in Truth and Politics whether facts, independent of opinion and interpretation, exist at all. She nonetheless goes on to add that though these and a great many more perplexities inherent in the historical sciences are real, there are no argument against the existence of factual matter. To me, it's unclear, however, how this factual matter, if it's always subject to interpretation, is in any meaningful sense fundamentally unpolitical. Lies are unpolitical until they're used politically. The same surely applies to truth. The distinction between truth and lies on the grounds of their basic the basic political power of the latter seems to me rather strange. Furthermore, Arendt has herself reasonably sanguine about petty lies told to deceive political opponents. This sort of deception in politics, she admits, is nothing new and could not alone lead to the destruction of factuality because it still leaves the deceiver aware of the truth. Lies, she says, have always been regarded as necessary and justifiable tools, not only of the politicians or the demagogues, but also of the statesman's trade. To explain Arendt's pessimism in Lying and Politics therefore requires attention to her distinctive claim that the largest threat to factual truth was the fact that the men prosecuting the war were not merely deceivers, but self-deceivers. Selling a chimerical image of American power from the outset, political, military, and administrative officials alike lost their grasp on basic factual truths, to the point where political reality was abandoned entirely. This change from the old way of lying to the big lie that everyone, even those who started it, believe, seems less to do with lies and far more to do with her critique of totalitarian ideology and her narrative of political and social modernity. This baggage ought to make us hesitate before drawing insights from her writings on truth and lies, partly because of their historical specificity, and partly because in retrospect, their political and philosophical virtues are questionable. In a much earlier essay, Ideology and Terror, published in 1953, Arendt described ideologies as all-embracing deductive systems, claiming to be scientific guides to nature in the case of Nazism, or to history in the case of Stalinism. To be clear, her definition of ideology here has a narrower sense than in ordinary usage, and a markedly different one to that used by her Frankfurt School contemporaries. The key feature of an ideology was the pseudo-logical consistency with which it purported to explain events, impervious to refutation by mere facts. Nazi race ideology and adulterated Marxian dialectics were all examples of this. The specific content of an ideological doctrine was not as important as the iron consistency of its argumentative structure and its contempt for factuality. For example, socialism, in her mind, did not constitute an ideology because it was a complex of views about the working class and the causes and remedies of its condition. In the early 20th century, she argues, the broad political appeal of ideological systems such as Nazism and Bolshevism was that they promised insight into large, inhuman historical processes to masses of alienated and atomized men. Writing about the trial of Nazi official Adolf Eichmann in the early 1960s in Israel, as US involvement in Vietnam escalated, Arendt would write again about ideology, but with less emphasis on propaganda and more on the self-deception of American leaders. Here's one illustrative example from her writings on Eichmann, of the careful control of language and the dissemination of lies that she believed operated under the Nazi regime. Discussing the simple lie that the war was a battle of destiny for the German people, she noted several defactualizing claims given to the population. First, this lie emphasized the war was no simple war. Second, that destiny, not Germany, was responsible for it. Third, that it was a matter of life and death for the Germans. However, the key component, she argued, leading to self-deception was the process by which Nazi leaders made good the deception by blinding themselves to political facts and turning war into precisely a matter of life and death for the German people, despite it not being so to begin with. They thereby, in Arendt's terminology, lied the world, striving to align reality with the original lie. Arendt saw parts of this characterization of ideology structuring a wide variety of intellectual and political phenomena in American political and intellectual life. In the post-war period, she inveighed, for example, in many articles and reviews, against the psychological and social sciences for what she describes in Lying and Politics as their tendency to deal with hypotheses and mere theories as though they were established facts. She also saw in the anti-communist writers of the post-war period what she described as a post-war comprehensive ideology. Originally, I quote, the brainchild of former communists who needed a new ideology by which to explain and reliably foretell the course of history. The ideologists here are all vaguely defined, according to Arendt's own prescription that the content of the doctrine was not as relevant as the drive for logical consistency within it. The game theorists, system analysts, and policy specialists of the Pentagon all inherited the same tendencies, what she described as, quote, the inability or unwillingness to consult experience and to learn from reality. The result, she argued, was self-deception. As Pentagon officials began believing their own propaganda regarding the Viet Cong and American power, they sought to lie the truth by creating realities that didn't exist in pursuit of an image of omnipotence. Arendt's explanation for the radical shift in the history of the lie drew on American political history and a personal experience of it. However, it also drew on a much earlier analysis of ideology in totalitarianism and its role in defactionalization. The parallels between a writing on Vietnam-era policymaking and totalitarian ideology seem clear enough. This isn't to say that she drew any strong analogies between fascism and the American polity. The pursuit of the image of global power by a republic she feared was turning into an empire was not comparable to fascism. Consequently, she believed the effects of constant lying and self-deception on the part of elites in America would be widespread cynicism about politics amongst citizens, not the rise of a totalitarian movement. The political sphere would be undermined by the failure to cultivate any sense of the importance of political judgment or the consequences of political action, as opposed to sterile, narrow calculation that now predominated. The bleak outlook that emerges from these essays, along with much of her other late writings, cannot be satisfactorily explained, I think, with reference only to her reuse of the concept of ideology. Arendt's attitude towards the realities and possibilities of the contemporary public sphere always exhibited a heavy dose of pessimism, juxtaposed with a certain idealization of the Greek polis. If we're thinking about her most unhappy reflections on politics, after those of totalitarianism, but obviously inflected with that phenomena, then it may be helpful to situate her alongside other genealogists of modernity and the public. There was a long and lugubrious tradition of pessimism, to which interwar Germany was no exception, about the possibilities of publics to bring authentic existence to modernity. It goes without saying that, phenomenological method aside, Arendt's democratic orientation was radically different from that of her once mentor Heidegger. But in her post-war years, and most notably in her writings on totalitarianism, she expressed a similarly strong animus against mass man, or in Heidegger's terminology, das man, and mass society. Her positive valuation of the public sphere, in contrast to some of her German intellectual influences, was more about its idealized possibilities than an assessment of its contemporary realities. The idealization of an abstract and singular public sphere sits in an uneasy but mutual relationship with her radical disappointment with its manifestations in reality. Alongside a repeated use of a concept of ideology derived from totalitarianism and a history of the putative public sphere, Arendt also had a detailed narrative of modernity. This, I think, creates another obstacle to using her writing on lies and history for the contemporary context. I'll take one key aspect of this narrative to illustrate. According to Arendt, the rise of the social in the modern Western world blurred the distinction between private and public spheres. The social she defined as the sphere of production and consumption, developing alongside the market economy from the early modern period onwards. The result was that the satisfaction of material needs she viewed as proper to the private sphere became a priority of the political sphere. This ensured the banality and fallenness of public political life. The infamously rigid distinction she employs between the public and private is, in many ways, untenable, related to serious omissions in her economic analysis and leading to a view of economic struggles as fundamentally pre-political. As even as sympathetic commentator as Hannah Pitkin has suggested, her idea of the political, pressed on all sides by an encroaching social, is strangely empty, too restrictive to provide a useful understanding of what political agents historically have argued and come into conflict about. More to the point, philosophers in recent years, Professor Goyce included, have questioned the value of public-private distinctions for political or philosophical analysis in general. The transition from non-political to political, Inherent's ontology of truth, depends on this split between private and public, and the relative autonomy of the public sphere. Having simultaneously asserted the importance of factual truths in grounding human existence, but also their fragility, Arendt doesn't want to submit them, factual truths that is, too quickly to the rough and tumble of the political realm. The reason for this, she says, is that when politicized, factual truths quickly acquire status as doxa, opinion. The value of the Pentagon Papers, Arendt argues, lay precisely in their emergence from the heart of organized lying and self-deception. In contrast, facts, when adopted by politicized groups who seek to benefit from their promulgation, are rapidly reduced to the status of doxa. This is perhaps the reason for Arendt holding to a relatively crude conception of factual truth. The existential importance of reality means that factual truths need insulation from the contestation of the public sphere. On the same note, the distinction Arendt makes between factual and rational truth seems connected to an overriding concern to keep moralizing scientific or mathematical philosophies away from the public sphere. Factual truth informs politics and the cultivation of judgment, while rational truth can only inform philosophical speculation and the cultivation of reflection. Formulas that Arendt believes would reduce politics to calculation rather than understanding and judgment are kept away. However, if the existential valences and spatial metaphors Arendt uses to describe her public realm are not enough to rescue it for contemporary use, then all these fine distinctions in her concept of truth break down. The domination of the big lie begins to seem less monolithic. As I hope I've shown, there are problems with using Arendt's view of the relationship between truth and the lie in politics. These are partly to do with a delineation of these concepts, but also because of the presence of some quite heavy political and contextual baggage. Lastly, I'd like to point to an aspect of her reflections in these essays that I think can be rescued, and that Professor Carruth brings out strongly in her passage on explosive histories and the possibility of bearing witness. One of the concluding points, pointing to, I quote, a historicity that does not submit itself entirely to the absolute violence of the lie, suggests a less explored approach to Arendt's discussion of truth and lies. It seems to me that Arendt's factual truth, in this respect, is most helpfully viewed as synonymous with a kind of concept of history, or at least something approximating the conditions of historical knowledge. Factual truth, defined as knowledge of contingent human events, but also believed by many diverse groups, so long as it's not overtly politicized, sounds a lot like Arendt's notion of remembrance that she outlines elsewhere. This would also account for the curious mixture of fragility, or constructivism, and thereness, or positivism, in the outline she gives of the concept of factual truth. There's something brute, or in other words, a stubbornness about factual truth, but at the same time a fragility, because it relies on webs of human relationships and constant retelling to sustain. In both these essays, Truth in Politics and Lying in Politics, Arendt suggests that the maintenance of factual truth requires both agents, institutions, and narratives. For example, in Truth in Politics, Arendt specifies some of the institutional conditions of factual truth centered on the universities. In her words, I quote, "The historical sciences and the humanities, which are supposed to find out, stand guard over, and interpret factual truth and human documents." The naivety of this view of supposedly non-political institutions such as universities performing helpfully stabilizing political functions is tempered by Arendt's view of historical remembrance as a specifically political activity, a form of action open to contestation. As Carruth says early on in her piece, the political sphere maintains itself not only as the site of action, but also as the site of its remembrance. For, quoting Arendt, speech and action possess an enduring quality of their own because they create their own remembrance. To continue quoting Professor Carruth, more specifically, they create political bodies that establish the conditions for remembrance, that is, for history. History thus seems central to the functioning of the political world, both as its memory and as the ground upon which the political world builds a future. This, I argue, points to a sort of hermeneutics tempered by a view of political action and an awareness of the threat posed by the control of information by the modern state. Though this involves, to some degree, Baudelaireizing Arendt, I find it more apposite than an idea of redemptive testimony in a world dominated by lying, an interpretation which, admittedly, Arendt's two essays more obviously lend themselves to.
I'd like to thank both of you for taking the time to engage seriously with my essay. I appreciate that, and I'm honored by it. I'm going to respond first to Professor Goyce, and thank you for having given me your text in advance to allow me to respond forcefully to what you said. And then I will respond to Dr. Yacob, which I have listened to, so it may not be as detailed. But I also have questions about some things you said at the end that I'd like to hear more about. First of all, I think in Professor Goyce's description of Arendt's piece as well as my own, there are some misconceptions that, and then there are also disagreements, but I'd like to clear up some of the misconceptions so that we can get to the disagreement. First of all, Arendt is not in either essay claiming to be against lying. In fact, she, especially in the essay Lying in Politics, she says that it would be useless to bemoan the prevalence of lying in the Vietnam War if after discovering the Pentagon Papers. She says because that would ignore the history of lying that goes way back to the beginning. And in fact, she says that lying has always been an important part of politics. And this is why when Jacques Derrida reads her, a little bit reads her pieces in his History of the Lie, he talks about her as wanting to do an analysis of lying beyond good and evil. She says that lying is the only form of action that confirms human freedom. And what I became interested in was precisely the shift away from a moralizing against lying, but saying lying is actually necessary to the freedom and action. The way I understand it, it's a difficult, subtle statement, would be something like this, that action for her is not something that you could determine in advance. And if we were to say that, if we were to always know that an action is a true action, then it would, in a sense, be determined. And the possibility of the perverse form of action, false action, thus allows an uncertainty about what is true. And that would thus constitutes it precisely as action, i.e., that is, as not determined in advance. That's how I understand it. It may not be how she did. So the lie, this is the traditional lie, and in fact, I would say, perhaps, Arendt might not say it this way, that from the point of view of the modern lie, Arendt would indeed like nothing more than to return to the politics of the traditional lie, because the traditional lie is the world in which the lie serves politics and in which you can at least find out the distinction between the traditional and the traditional lie, the lie that is, and the fact, whereas in the modern realm, the realm of the modern lie, that may not be possible. Now, with regard to the word lie, and I understand this is confusing both in her work and probably in my own essay on her, the big lie, you said, Professor Goyce said, it is this intentional propagation of something that is known to be false. But actually, for Arendt, the what she calls the modern lie or organized lie is no longer something that can be associated with the intentional act of an individual who knows the difference, because this is the realm in which something like self-deception is taking place. And beyond that, and this is more difficult because it's implicit in her essays and very difficult to figure out exactly what she's talking about. Derrida has some ideas on this, but it's not clear in her essays. It has to do with what she calls image making. So image making is not exactly, it's not a totalitarian state, right? Image making she associates more with democratic states, but a world in which the image, that is the capacity for modern media reproduction of images in part, and that's not totally what she means by image in that essay, can get to a point of mediating or even replacing, that is destroying factuality as such, so that we don't any longer even ask the question of whether something is true or false anymore. And here I would again refer, because I don't talk about it at length here, to this brief comments in the essay History of the Lie by Derrida, who talks about the performativo mediatic world. But regardless, the lie, here she's talking about a kind of mediatic, and it's no longer representational, it's actually, it acts. So it's a kind of image-making as action that destroys the world that it would presumably, that replaces the world it would presumably represent. So there we're no longer, we're in a world we're no longer talking about traditional forms of intentional lying, and that I think is what is concerning to her. Secondly, I'd say that the distinction between truth-telling and lying is not simply, is not about the simplicity of the truth, but rather about what she calls its mode of assertion. That is, truth-telling is constitutive, referential, if we put it in linguistic terms, and lying is aimed because it's intentional, aimed at persuasion, and thus has a performative dimension that's not immediately evident in truth-telling. However, both of you made a point that I think I would agree with after a certain analysis, is that she does want to maintain the distinction between the performativity, the active quality of lying, and the seemingly constitutive non-active quality of truth-telling. But of course, if we were to take her own analysis seriously, that is, we could be in the realm of the modern lie now. It's not something you'd ever know, because that's the realm in which you precisely don't know anymore, the distinction between truth and falsehood. Then we would have to take seriously the possibility that the notion of a fact is itself produced by the world of the modern lie, and that there may be from the beginning a dimension of fact truth-telling, and hence of facts, that is no longer simply to be reduced to, let's say, making visible what is merely available. I think that's implicit in her essay, and that's why I focus so much on the date, August 4th, 1914. I think she performs that rethinking of the fact around August, the example of August 4th, 1914, which is no longer, the example rhetorically in her essays is not a simple telling of what is out there, because that fact is not a simple fact, nor is the dropping of the bomb. So that was, in a sense, responding to the point that both of you were making, that there may be facts that are not simple facts, and I think she inscribes that. Just a point about doxa. Arendt argues that doxa, when a fact is turned into an opinion, it can be a form of lying. And I would give an example here of my colleague, Deborah Lipstadt, who says that she's written a book on Holocaust denial, and she's constantly asked to go on shows to argue with people who are showing the other side, the other side, that is, the other opinion about the Holocaust. So let's have a debate. And she says that there is a performative dimension to Holocaust denial, which is not one opinion versus another. The moment you turn it into two opinions, you're in the realm of the lie. And that's at least how Arendt thinks of the use of doxa as a form of lying. And then I would say, again, and this you also brought up, which I would respond again to Professor Goyce, that the truth teller in the world of the modern lie acts. And Ellsberg, for Arendt, I believe, she doesn't talk about him directly, but it's certainly in my essay, Ellsberg is acting. He is not in just making available truth. She herself says these are not truths. He himself doesn't believe that what he did was, why he was effective had anything to do with the exposure of the truth. So that's why I tried to argue he was breaking a promise to lie, which is a performative, that the effect of what he did had to do with a reflection, not a reflection, but an action back on the status of the media in which he was working himself. And so, again, it's that form of what I have called testimony, and I'd like to hear more about what you have to say about that, actually, is not at all a form of simple truth-telling. And finally, again, I would just point that to the fact that this is not about the end of history, but rather about trying to rethink the nature of history when it seems its status seems to have changed. I agree that her analysis of the movement from the traditional to the modern lie and the points at which it seems to historically have changed may be allegorical. It may not be that we can simply take it at face value, especially if it's written from within the world of the modern lie. We have to then ask the status of any narrative. But I do think that nonetheless, the status of history has to be thought of as change. So she's trying to think change, but from the perspective of facts that are no longer precisely simple facts. And hence, I do think that although there is a pessimism, that it's through this, the extremity of the possibility of complete denial, that she allows for precisely something that might have a possibility of intervening politically. So it's, I mean, Derrida actually said she's too optimistic, but in any case. And then I just wanted to then basically respond to you. Some of it I've already been doing, that I do think that we have to question the distinction between fact, simple fact as non-political and political action of the lie. But I think that it's not something, I think it needs to take a root of argument that, first of all, we still do have a distinction that we operate with, as WikiLeaks and others do recognize, but that it's only by understanding what's at stake in the denial of fact that we could come to understand what a new fact, what it would mean to operate in a world of new facts. And I think Arendt allows us to do it, even though she doesn't press it herself. So I think her essays, again, in the August 4th, 1914 example, I think she's doing it. She's not reflecting on it. And I think her writing does tell us something about where we might go with it, that new thinking of the fact. About self-deception, I would just say this is a reading of Daniel, in part a reading. She's getting self-deception not only from a philosophical place, but from a direct reading of Daniel Ellsberg's papers on the war and his fantastic essay, The Quagmire Myth and the Stalemate Machine, in which he shows he wrote it while still underground after having released the papers, in which he shows that the quagmire myth is the myth that we went in step by step, not knowing what was going on. And he shows the ways in which systematic deception turned into self-deception over and over and over again, what he called a spiraling stalemate that had a machine-like quality. It's kind of a version of repetition compulsion. So every time there was a crisis, the president was told he either had to accelerate, that's not the word, but send in a lot more soldiers or get out. And he could do neither, because if he put a lot in, it would turn into Korea. If he took them out, he'd be soft on communism. So either way, he wouldn't be elected. So he puts in a few, knowing that it will create a stalemate. And then the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese withdraw. And then the U.S. government looks, in order to figure out what's going on, some more soldiers have come. The U.S. looks at the withdrawal and says, oh, we really are winning. And then, so they put in a few, the government puts in a few soldiers, says to the U.S., we're going to win the war now. That's the deception. When the other side withdraws a little bit, that's the moment of self-deception. And then we say we're winning, and then the Tet Offensive happens or something. And he shows this happening over and over again. So she's reading that, and then trying to radicalize it, I think, by saying people are self-deceived from the beginning. So it's an interesting relation between the two. And again, then just to come back to this question of pessimism, I do think she has her own optimism. She says at the end of the essay, as long as we have a free press, we'll be fine. But I think she's already shown that the free press alone as facts is not what's important. But what Ellsberg did, which doesn't seem to be necessarily possible anymore, was, again, to break the secrecy, that is, to do a performative, to take classified document. Whether or not that would work anymore, I don't know. I guess my final question to you would be, you made a distinction at the end between testimony and something else that I didn't quite catch, and I thought, and I wanted to understand more about what that was about. So thank you again to both of you.
We've had a philosopher, a political theorist, and we've had a literary theorist, which I think are three very different ways of reading, apart from anything. So perhaps that might be a place to start. Yes.
I have a case that I'd be curious to hear you address. The Tea Party in the United States, the ultra-conservative party, held a rally recently where they had three demands: cutting taxes, deregulating, which are perfectly understandable, and the third one was stop teaching critical history of the United States. And on the one hand, I thought it was terrifying. On the other hand, I thought it was hilarious, because by acknowledging that there is a critical So my question then is, do we take this optimistically as a happy functioning public sphere where we get to debate these things, or do we take it as history is purely image and might be a case of a modern lie?
Can I say something? I look at a lot of this psychoanalytically, I'm afraid. I just think that much of Arendt is motivated by hysteria. I mean, it's over the top. It's the fear. So just imagine what sort of person you'd have to be to worry about whether whether truth itself was threatened, or whether factual reality was threatened, or whether it was all really just an image. That, I mean, to worry in that way is already a sign of the wrong psychological disposition. Reality is there, and I mean, one does, you know. So anyway, my response to that is, this will take care of itself. Hysteria doesn't, in a way, doesn't need to be treated. It isn't that history dissolves itself; it's that these hysterical fears will cure themselves.
I think what you've offered, Raymond, is something I think consider very unpsychoanalytic, actually.
Okay.
Which is an application to the character.
Okay.
Of
someone's
of
work.
Event.
Okay.
Yes. No.
Okay.
But I think what I'd like to come back to is the question of the image and the figure, because I think that what Kathy's essay was doing, and in a way, both of you in very different ways, focused in on Arendt, I think, primarily. And I think what Kathy kept doing in her response was to talk about a particular reading, particular moments in Arendt that could be read.
Yes.
And perhaps we could just go down that avenue a little bit. And Kathy, you look as though you have something to say. Do you want to come up here?
Okay.
Yes, let's move along, and then you can. Can we move
yes.
right along? Yes.
Well, certainly that comes up in the problem of the fact that has been brought up by both of you,
mm-hmm.
which is she herself maintains the distinction thematically or in terms of her doctrine between truth-telling and lying, although the modern lie has a slightly different status from the traditional lie. But she still says truth is denied, and she maintains a notion of the fact. But on the level of the way she writes, her example of August 4th, 1914 operates as something different. And that's what I was trying to show, that that her own writing, in a sense, bears witness to the change in factuality that she herself hasn't theorized, but has pushed us toward. That is, we need to rethink the nature of the fact, if in fact we can have a world that is entirely embraced by the modern lie, and if we still want to think of it in the terms of any kind of action or possibility of action, we have to rethink that. And I think that's why I focused on the question of August 4th, 1914, and the status of the explosion. That figure emerging not in the two essays, but in The Origins of Totalitarianism, because there it is a figure. By the time we get to the dropping of the bomb, the explosion is not operating as a figure. But the status of that figure suggests that her writing does more than it refers to. So she refers to the dropping of the bomb, but she figures the event in history as an explosion. And that figure enacts something about the fact and about its witness that I think she doesn't theorize. So that's why I think I both agree and disagree with what some of the comments that have been made here today, that she asks us to rethink the fact, or she forces us to, and she, in a sense, performs it in her own text beyond what she theorizes, which is why I would say that, if anything, Heidegger might have paid more attention to her. I certainly don't think she needed to pay any more attention to Heidegger than she paid plenty of attention to Heidegger in many ways. So,
not the right kind.
I think she did actually pay perfectly the right kind. And so I think that, so in that sense, the literary reading is not to be opposed, hopefully, simply to political or philosophical readings. I would hope that the literary allows us to recognize forms of possible intervention in history that are also forms of beginning, since the literary could also be a form of beginning that could then touch on the political realm as well as a realm of imagination, because the realm of the image is also the realm of imagination. She was working on Kant and thinking about the imagination. The image would be, in the world of the modern life, image making would be kind of, again, for her, a perverse or false imagination that always takes place in action. This distinction, perverse and non-perverse, I do think one has to question and then rethink all of the terms together. But certainly her, you're right, and thank you for bringing out what I'm trying to do here, is to
there's a kind of symmetry between her moments of hesitation that where something might start again and what I think you're suggesting a reading can do. It allows us to start again in some sense, not necessarily beyond, but in a somewhat different way. That Derrida also, I haven't read that particular essay, but the Derrida and other readings of Arendt, whom he both agrees with and disagrees with, but in interesting ways, because he sees her terms as always being able to be, as it re-economized within the structure that she's actually trying to displace.
I mean, I think he doesn't give her enough credit either, actually. He says she's very optimistic and she makes truth. The lie is part of, thus, a part of, because of her optimism, a part of a parousia of truth. I'm not sure. She also says we could imagine a world in which the lie is absolute, but she won't stay with that. We don't know. But it's true. He does at least allow for the different voices of Arendt to come out. Yeah.
Lindsay.
Yeah, I just want to come back to that. Yeah. Literally in the imagination.
Yeah.
When you were reading your essay, I was struck. By the beginning of the Truth and Politics essay, there's a very moving footnote where she refers back to Eichmann in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So this is why I'm writing this essay.
Yes.
And then she has this very powerful statement about witness. And she says, when history is taken away from the witnesses who are actually there.
Yeah.
And she's talking about herself.
Yes.
And she's talking about the way that the reception of Eichmann in Jerusalem refused her status as witness.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that question of witness then runs right across both the nine essays.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, in a more interesting way, through what she then does with judgment, what she then tries to do, retrieving judgment, that comes out in the lectures on Kant towards the end. I think it's very interesting that she returns to Kant. And she kind of romanticizes his romanticization of the historical spectator, and tries to retrieve that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'd be quite interesting to sort of run that history of witness. Because back to where you were last night, in some ways, the history. The testimony, the language of ashes, how do you actually articulate that in a political sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. The other thing is just a kind of footnote about how you might think about literature and Arendt's political philosophy or journalism. Is the person who took up the baton for Arendt in more than one ways than one, of course, Mary McCarthy, who both in her, is it the seventh degree, her Vietnam essays, uses an Arendtian framework in order to write about Vietnam and the Medina trial, but also then goes on to edit Life of the Mind when Arendt dies. But that's again an act of remembrance as far as Mary McCarthy is concerned, and witnessing again that project that Arendt started. That's more of a footnote. I think what I wanted to put into the question of remembrance, imagination, was the question of judgment that seemed to be implicit in
the
I guess I want to follow on from where Kathy left off and then join in with that. I should say, actually, I'm a historian, so this is going to be an intellectual history point, but there's an interesting parallel, actually, in Arendt's engagement with Walter Benjamin on issues of aesthetics and a vision of modernity as catastrophe, drawing on his theses on the philosophy of history, and your reading of the August the 4th moment, the explosion that sets off the chain reaction, because Arendt, when she's coming from France on a ship full of refugees to New York, actually has Benjamin's manuscript of the thesis on the philosophy of history, and in her essays in the 40s, this concept of modernity as catastrophe, the figure of the angel of history, is something she keeps coming back to, and she refers to that occasionally or alludes to it in Origins of Totalitarianism, and then in the mid-60s comes back to it when she writes her introduction to Benjamin's reflections, illuminations, I'm confused. So I guess what I want to then fall onto is to say that she is engaging with aesthetics and modernity and the role machine-like processes in modernity have to image making and images all the way through, and they're actually, you don't so much need to do, there's a possibility of not having to do an esoteric, particularly esoteric reading of her because of her engagement with Benjamin over the years. And then also in her late work where she talks about Kant's critique of judgment and the historical spectator, there's also a sense in which aesthetics becomes an important category for cultivating political judgment. So there's a link between art and aesthetics in her mind and a good political spectator. I guess I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
I think that's nice. In fact, I was wondering when her use of the word image was actually built, and that with its Benjaminic dialectical build, that David can talk about this much better than me, but the idea that the explosion is explosion of the in the present of the meaning of the past. But I don't know, David, if you just want to come in there and
I'm making you think about the ways Benjamin talks about blasting something out of continuities and continuance as a way of trying to deal with the rest of history. But part of the issue which is posed there is that does not endure.
What did you
it
say?
It does not endure. You know, it's precisely that which disappears, like the lightning flash, which cannot be retained. So there's a very different sense of, you know, if you talk about factuality there, right, of something occurring as an event, its inability to sustain itself means that whatever politics is envisioned there in relationship to history is not a politics which is able to do more than refer back to itself as having had happened. So what you end up getting, instead of the possibility of a truth of politics, it's always a truth is disappearing, but it's only known by that disappearing. Which means that there's something interesting here when you're back in the Arendt Heidegger context of the notion of Aletheia and Heidegger, as precisely a certain kind of concealment is taking place in relationship to both politics and truth. And that would go all the way back into, and because I think, Kathy, you had said something earlier, I can't remember exactly what the phrase was in the introduction, and it struck me, it's very, very like the passage in The Origin of a Work of Art, when Heidegger speaks about politics is one way in which truth happens. The art of work is another way in which truth happens. The thinking of the philosopher is another way in which truth happens. So that set up there, these kind of parallel structures, none of which is essential. In other words, it doesn't have precedent over another, but they each give rise to history. And the history is always the conceding or forgetting or disappearing by kind of that notion of truth. And I think that probably connects up with some things that you've been thinking through in relation to the trauma and historicality. That concealment is repeated. And so that the task then is to try and recall or remember that repetition as the disappearing or the disappearing of the trace of truth. So I think those kind of issues might float around in ways that takes back that notion of explosion and why that is being used. And perhaps even goes back to, because when we were talking earlier, I was thinking, okay, we refer to the atomic bomb. How is it that we know the atomic bomb? We always know it by the moment of detonation. Right? We rarely see it as anything else. And so it's always the explosion, but we don't see what it does. There's a way in which that image has kind of preserved or protected something that, so it can be repeated and repeated and repeated. But what it means, it's never brought to us. The image always gets between us.
So it refers to itself and not itself. It's interesting because a certain kind of photography was invented. Actually, well, I, at the moment that those images were being denied by Hiroshima, by the U.S. government, they were also developing a mode of photography, rapatronic photography, I think it's called, that can capture the moment of the actual explosion itself. So it was also the form of literally a new form of image making, but I guess when at the same time as a suppression of images, which would be interesting to analyze through what you said.
And also, because obviously that essentially is applied, which becomes colliding. It becomes that we never see it, it's always a colliding.
Thank you.
This has obviously been just the beginning of a longer conversation, but we're already running 50 minutes over, which I think is because of the richness of the contributions and responses.